Railroaded was created and produced by the Free Ross team. I'm allowing them to use my podcast to reach a wider audience and hopefully raise awareness of Ross's plight and his fight for clemency. This is the best chance to stop Ross spending the rest of his life in prison. The information presented in Railroaded is based solely on the public record and should not be attributed to myself, Ross Ulbricht, Lynn Ulbricht, or anyone connected with FreeRoss.org. I'm not responsible and do not verify for accuracy any of the information contained within this series. While I'm close to the case due to my interviews with Lynn, I've not been involved in any of the production of the series. There will be additional information about the case and links to my previous interview with Lynn in the show notes and information on how you can help support the campaign at the end of the show. If you have any questions, feel free to get in touch.
Railroaded. The Targeting and Caging of Ross Ulbricht. Episode 3 of a 6-part series. This episode includes chapters 11 through 14, The Arrest, Deleting Evidence, Fighting for Freedom, and Finding the Servers. Chapter 11, The Arrest. Paul Rosenberg, author, engineer, and consultant to NASA and the U.S. military, said, "The prosecution's forensic evidence was below amateur level. The tools used were bad choices, and when the metadata are exactly the same for every file, it's inescapably clear that they've been altered. To then submit them as evidence is laughable, or would be, if so much wasn't at stake." By this time, DPR had convinced Ross to get involved with Silk Road again and given him access to some of the DPR accounts, along with many of the files, software, and records being used to run it. Everything Barrara and Turner needed to make a case against Ross was on his laptop, including a Bitcoin wallet with over 144,000 Bitcoins. On October 1, 2013, the day of his arrest, Ross was in his local library downloading the Colbert Report. Plainclothes agents were watching him, and Der Jagen was across the street in a cafe, logged on as Cirrus. Der Jagen initiated a chat to DPR's account, which popped up on Ross's screen now that he had access to it. Der Jagen needed Ross to log on to DPR's Silk Road account, so the arrest team could claim that he was DPR at the time of his arrest. To do this, he messaged that he was having difficulty with the admin tool he used to remove inappropriate flagged listings on Silk Road. In response, Ross logged in and waited for the page to load as it bounced through the Tor network. Having little knowledge of the inner workings of DPR's enterprise, Ross messaged Cirrus, "You did Bitcoin exchange before you started working for me, right?" Something the real DPR would have known, having chatted and worked with Cirrus for many months. Once Ross logged in, undercover agents immediately created a diversion, while others tore Ross's laptop from him and handcuffed him. At the arrest scene was FBI agent Thomas Kiernan. He was the first to take possession of the laptop and immediately started punching commands into the computer. He plugged his USB drive in and began copying files without producing digital fingerprints, which are unique snippets of data that would have ensured the copies matched the originals. By doing so, he overwrote some of the metadata for those files unnecessarily. Kiernan triaged the laptop in the library for 1 or 3 hours, depending on when he was asked. Then he transported it to Ross's house, about 8 blocks away. All that time, Kiernan was in sole possession of the laptop with nothing more than a few photos from his phone to document what he did with it. At Ross's house, agents found 2 USB drives with Silk Road files on them and a crumpled piece of paper with notes about Silk Road's vendor review system. At this point, Kiernan turned the laptop over to Christopher Beeson of RCFL, a private contractor in San Francisco. Beeson also overwrote metadata by creating tar archives, similar to zip files, of commonly used directories on the laptop. He later admitted he was not familiar with the Guidelines for Evidence Collection and Archiving, which clearly states not to run programs like tar that modify metadata. During the tar process, Beeson was stopped by a failure he was never able to determine the cause of, nor could he confirm he had properly copied the files. By this time, it was almost 8 p.m. Beeson stopped what he was doing and attempted to make a copy of the laptop's hard drive using DD, a powerful tool colloquially referred to as Disk Destroyer because, if misused, it can cause irreparable harm to the data being manipulated. He ran DD several times while trying to generate a digital fingerprint, but it kept failing. Eventually, Beeson just skipped the fingerprinting altogether and made a copy that didn't match the original. Duryagin reviewed this copy all that night and into the next morning and continued to find evidence of Karpeles' involvement and associations to Silk Road. "Karpeles is purging everything after Ross's arrest," he wrote to Alford and Turner. "I know he was initially involved." Duryagin continued to submit reports to them on Karpeles' finances and communications, but to no avail. In fact, the government continued working with Karpeles after Ross's arrest, as Duryagin learned that even more information was passed from Karpeles to Baltimore. On October 3rd, 2 days after the laptop was initially seized, Beeson turned his attention to the data in the laptop's RAM. What happened to the computer over those 2 days remains unknown. But again, there were problems. First, Kiernan and Beeson had overwritten or modified the data with all they had done up to that point. Also, Beeson wasn't quite sure how to do the RAM capture and had to ask for assistance and look up documentation. He tried anyway and crashed the computer, losing unknown information and locking the laptop behind encryption. How true the copy Beeson extracted was to the original Kiernan seized is unknowable. Nor can it be known what exactly Kiernan did with the laptop before handing it over to Beeson, or what data was lost when Beeson crashed the computer. It is indisputable, however, that the laptop was not handled professionally. Both agents ignored order of volatility guidelines, overwrote data unnecessarily, and used obsolete and unreliable methods. Files used in the government's case against Ross were modified as much as 6 hours after his arrest. Not one photo taken by Kiernan or Beeson to document their work showed the correct time. Yet, all this evidence was admissible at trial. Beeson eventually sent Kiernan, who was now in New York, the copy he had made of the laptop's hard drive and the laptop itself, which Kiernan called a useless brick. Kiernan made another copy of Beeson's copy, and Barrara used this as the basis for his case against Ross. All evidence used against Ross from the laptop was a screenshot of a copy that never matched the original. 2 years after he called for the shutdown of Silk Road, Schumer finally got what he wanted. The site was taken down on October 1, 2013, and Barrara ensured that Ross would be prosecuted in New York instead of California, where he lived and was arrested. Ross spent the next 6 weeks in solitary confinement, first in San Francisco, and then in New York, while the government combed through the data Kiernan and Beeson had collected. Chapter 12. Deleting Evidence. Lynn Ulbricht, Ross Ulbricht's mother, said, "If this backup of the forum database had not been found, if logins made by DPR after Ross's arrest were not discovered, no one would be the wiser. This begs the question, how much more is there?" Sometime after his arrest, and possibly weeks prior, one or more of the few people with access to the evidence in Ross's case would come very close to removing any trace of the conversation between Not Wonderful and DPR. That conversation made clear that someone from the Baltimore office was selling DPR information about the government's investigation. This could have been whoever was behind the Not Wonderful account, trying to protect themselves, or anyone with high-level access and a vested interest in seeing Ross convicted. The revelation that DPR was being helped by law enforcement could potentially unravel the entire case. The conversation was originally in evidence in several locations. One was the live version on the Silk Road forum, while three others were in backups of the live version that Tarbell made copies of. However, the dialogue could not be found anywhere in any of these four locations. All traces of it had been deleted. Miraculously, a fifth copy of the conversation was overlooked by whomever removed the others. It was buried in the 4 terabytes of evidence dumped on Ross and his legal team. This copy appeared to be created manually by a Silk Road user with administrative privileges and saved in his home folder on the Silk Road forum server. Whoever tried to cover Not Wonderful's tracks didn't delete this obscure copy and failed to eliminate all evidence of those communications. However, even this copy was incomplete because it didn't contain any of the communications between Not Wonderful and DPR after it was created in mid-August 2013, even though payments continued until Silk Road was shut down in early October. It will never be known what information was sold to DPR in those crucial 6 weeks leading up to Ross's arrest. DPR made a critical mistake around this time. While Ross was still in solitary confinement, locked in a monitored cell with no access to the outside world, let alone the internet, DPR continued to log into his account on the Silk Road forum, which was still running until late November after the takedown of Silk Road itself. This is irrefutable evidence that Ross was not the only person with access to DPR's accounts. Chapter 13, Fighting for Freedom. Jay Lederman, criminal defense attorney, said, "The case comes in, it's a big splash, it's all over the news. Almost a year later, these big, mean, offensive counts get dropped. It's not a front-page story anymore. It's somewhere in the recesses of the paper. It's just not a big deal. At that point, people already associate the case with murder for hire. No prosecutor would ever say that's what they're doing. But as a long-term criminal defense attorney, this happens all the time." Ross hired New York attorney Joshua Dreitel to defend him. His first courtroom appearance in New York was presided over by Magistrate Judge Kevin Fox to determine if Ross would be granted bail. Turner, appointed by Barrara as lead prosecutor, claimed at the hearing that Ross was behind the murder-for-hire plot involving Green and brought up information from the laptop about 5 other murder-for-hire attempts. Dreitel was ambushed late the night before with this allegation, giving him no time to consult with Ross or prepare a defense. After using them to deprive Ross of bail, Turner dropped these allegations and never brought them to trial. Turner also asserted, without evidence, that Ross might have Bitcoin stashed away somewhere that he could use to fund an escape. Despite 70 letters to the court attesting that Ross was not a danger or flight risk, $1 million in pledges from many friends and family, including their homes and life savings, and the fact that Ross was a first-time offender, Judge Fox denied his Eighth Amendment right to bail. With Ross secure in prison custody, Turner's first communication with him was a threat. He told Ross that if he didn't plead guilty to the charges he was arrested for, which would force him to spend a minimum of 10 years in prison, then Turner would add the kingpin charge, raising the minimum to 20 years. Either way, Turner said he would recommend that the judge sentence Ross to life in prison without parole. The judge was Catherine Forrest, district court judge in the Southern District of New York, who had been officially recommended to the bench by Schumer. Ross refused to cooperate with Turner and was indicted on February 4, 2014, beginning the long, arduous process of defending himself against the federal government from within a Bureau of Prisons detention center. From the outset, Ross and Dreitel challenged Barrara's case on legal grounds. The charges were conspiring to distribute narcotics and fake identifications, hack computers, launder money, and the promised kingpin charge, typically reserved for drug lords sitting at the apex of a large organization they control with violence. Conspicuously absent from the New York indictment was any charge relating to either the murder plot that Force and Bridges staged with Green or the others used to deny Ross bail. The District of Maryland did include Green in a separate indictment. but dismissed it in its entirety nearly 5 years later. Dreitel argued that these charges have never been used to prosecute the conduct alleged against Ross, that he operated a website through which other persons, sellers and purchasers, committed illegal activity. Congress passed a law to protect providers of interactive computer services so they may operate without fear of civil liability for the content posted by others. Congress wanted a freewheeling internet that has flourished to the benefit of all with a minimum of government regulation. The law is broadly worded, with a provider needing only to show that the information was provided by a third party to qualify for immunity. This is precisely what Silk Road accomplished by design. It was an open platform, like many other e-commerce websites, with decisions about what to sell, at what price, and to whom left up to the users. This was exemplified by the fact that much more than drugs, fake IDs, and hacking software were available on the site. Items exchanged included jewelry, writing services, food, antibiotics, and other legal items. In fact, prior to this case, no internet service provider had been criminally charged for permitting content or even hosting websites that tolerate or even promote illegal activity. Google is the most common defendant in lawsuits where this law has been invoked, and other major ISPs and browsers have also regularly availed themselves of this immunity. With the lack of a single prosecution of a provider hosting illegal conduct, Ross's case constitutes arbitrary and discriminatory enforcement. Indeed, the gulf between civil immunity enjoyed by all other providers and the criminal liability and potential punishment Ross faces is incalculably vast. Judge Forrest apparently cared little about this double standard. She accommodated Turner, who argued that the federal criminal laws are expansive and adaptable and readily reach conduct online to the same extent as if it occurred on the street. She acknowledged that Silk Road was nothing more than code until third parties agreed to use it. Yet despite the fact that it was not, she declared that Silk Road was specifically and intentionally designed for the purpose of facilitating unlawful transactions. By saying this, she equated privacy and anonymity with all things illegal. To make Silk Road illegal as a whole, and not just the specific illegal transactions that occurred on the site, it had to be characterized as a vast criminal enterprise with Ross at the top. In her ruling, Judge Forrest falsely claimed that Ross posted a sign on a worldwide bulletin board that said, "I have created an anonymous, untraceable way to traffic narcotics," a statement Ross never posted. She called the website a vast conspiracy, saying that because each time someone signs up and agrees to Ross's standing offer, he or she may become a co-conspirator, and that Ross's alleged co-conspirators are several thousand drug dealers on Silk Road. Co-conspirators may not know each other's identity, she continued, and the fact that Silk Road was automated does not preclude the formation of a conspiracy. There is no requirement that any words be exchanged at all. The judge also falsely claimed that Ross designed, launched, and operated Silk Road for the specific purpose of facilitating narcotics transactions that he knew would occur. Analogizing a website host with a mafia boss, she said Ross acted as a sort of godfather. In court, Dreitel argued that companies like AT&T are in the same position. They know people are using their network for drug deals, they're texting, they're making calls. I know that, it's foreseeable to me. If I'm selling drugs to one person using my AT&T phone, does that make every other drug seller on AT&T a co-conspirator of mine? Does that make AT&T a co-conspirator? No. Ross made several other arguments, clearly showing that the government's charges could not be applied to the alleged conduct and violated his constitutional rights. In spite of this, Judge Forrest allowed the prosecution to proceed, denying the motion in its entirety. Chapter 14, Finding the Servers. Neil Franklin, Executive Director at Law Enforcement Action Partnership and 34-year police veteran, said, "We have become overly aggressive with our criminal justice system in the U.S. We imprison more people and apply longer sentences than any country on the face of the planet. People like Ross should be afforded the opportunity of redemption as soon as possible. For Ross, that is now." Ross also challenged the government's investigation itself. All the subpoenas and warrants used Tarbell's seizure of the Silk Road server as their starting point for probable cause. If the seizure had been done illegally, all subsequent evidence, including the information on the laptop, would be suppressed, and the government's case would fall apart. Ross filed a motion to suppress the evidence unless Tarbell could explain how he found the server. Tarbell claimed, under oath, that by examining the individual packets of data being sent back from the Silk Road website, he noticed that the headers of some of the packets contained a certain IP address. When he typed the IP address into an ordinary non-Tor web browser, a part of the Silk Road login screen, the CAPTCHA prompt, appeared, thus confirming that the IP address in the headers was the IP address of the Silk Road. Tarbell's explanation was closely scrutinized, because Tor is supposed to prevent exactly what he claimed he did. Cybersecurity experts worldwide, including Robert Graham of Errata Security, Brian Krebs of Krebs on Security, and Nicholas Weaver, researcher at ICSI and Berkeley, were highly skeptical. "I find it surprising that when given a chance to provide a cogent on-the-record explanation for how they discovered the server, they instead produced a statement that has been shown inconsistent with reality, and that they knew would be inconsistent with reality," Weaver said. Tarbell responded that he didn't record or save any of his work, violating the most rudimentary standards of computer forensic analysis. "The details are vague," Graham noted. "It is impossible for anybody with technical skills, such as myself, to figure out what he did. And the second problem is that some of the details are impossible, such as seeing the IP address in the packet headers. Furthermore, he saved none of the forensics data. You'd have thought that, had this been real, he would have at least captured packet logs, or even screenshots of what he did." Weaver explained exactly why Tarbell's story didn't make sense. "The server logs, which the FBI provides as evidence, show that, no, what happened is the FBI didn't see a leakage coming from that IP. What happened is they contacted that IP directly and got a PHP MyAdmin page. But how did they know to contact that IP address in the first place? The CAPTCHA couldn't leak in that configuration. And the IP Tarbell visited wasn't providing the CAPTCHA, but instead a PHP MyAdmin interface. Thus, the leaky CAPTCHA story is full of holes." The experts suspected another explanation. "Many of us believe it wasn't the FBI who discovered the hidden Silk Road server, but the NSA. We believe the FBI is using parallel construction, creating a plausible story of how they found the server to satisfy the courts, but a story that isn't true," Graham said. "I am a foremost expert on this sort of thing. I think Christopher Tarbell is lying." Given the massive breadth of the NSA's dragnet electronic surveillance, Dreitel later argued to the court, this case is a prime candidate for parallel construction, particularly in light of the Silk Road's exclusive operation on the Internet, and its use of both the Tor network and Bitcoin, as well as the intensity of the government's multi-year investigation aimed at finding the identity of those operating the website. According to Reuters, who first revealed the NSA's practice of parallel construction just 2 months before Ross's arrest, law enforcement agents receiving illegal information from the agency have been directed to conceal how such investigations truly begin, not only from defense lawyers, but also sometimes from prosecutors and judges. Whether the truth was concealed from Turner or not, he shot down the idea that the NSA was involved. Ulbricht offers no evidence of governmental misconduct to support this sweeping claim. Instead, he conjures up a boogeyman, the NSA, which he suspects was responsible for locating the Silk Road server. Turner called Dreitel's search for how the servers were actually found a pointless fishing expedition aimed at vindicating his misguided conjecture about the NSA being the shadowy hand behind the government's investigation. Turner reiterated Tarbell's explanation, which, despite widespread expert skepticism, did satisfy the court. Judge Forrest denied the defense's motion to suppress evidence and refused to allow an evidentiary hearing to determine the truth. More than 3 years later, Edward Snowden revealed that the NSA had worked urgently to target Bitcoin users in the months leading up to Ross's arrest. They used a program code named Oakstar, a collection of covert corporate partnerships, enabling the agency to monitor communications along fiber optic cables that undergird the internet. A classified March 8, 2003 NSA memo stated that they were using these capabilities in their mission of looking at cyber targets that utilize online e-currency. It is hard to imagine a higher priority government target using Bitcoin in 2013 than Silk Road and DPR. In addition, Turner lied to the court about how the government seized the server once Tarbell found it. He told the magistrate judge who signed off on the warrants that the U.S. government has a mutual legal assistance treaty, MLAT, with Iceland, where the server was located, thus giving him the legal authority to seize it. However, Turner later admitted that this is not technically correct, as the United States does not have an MLAT with Iceland. The legal basis for the warrant appears to have been unimportant to Judge Forrest. She ruled that the defense's motion to suppress is denied. In the same pretrial ruling, Judge Forrest rejected several other challenges to the investigation. Ross asserted his Fourth Amendment right to be secure against unreasonable searches and seizures, saying Turner violated his rights when he tracked him down and, using pen traps, gathered all his internet traffic information without a warrant. Turner also violated Ross's rights when he did eventually obtain warrants by sweeping up every scrap of information about Ross and his life going back over a decade from his laptop and email and Facebook accounts. His entire digital life was the government's to examine, despite the Fourth Amendment requiring the government to identify in advance the particular items they seek. At Turner's insistence, Judge Forrest also explicitly forbade Dreitel from conveying to the jury the political and philosophical motivations behind Silk Road, as some jurors might sympathize with those views. The jury was also not to know that Ross could be imprisoned for life if found guilty, in case they found this excessive. Also, at Turner's behest, the judge forbade Ross to acknowledge or smile at his family in the jury's presence, threatening increasingly necessary measures should he disobey. In the wake of Judge Forrest's rulings, the path was cleared for the government to bring Ross to trial. To be continued. Next episode will include chapters 15 to 17, The Cover-Up, Eviscerating the Defense, How Many DPRs? For a written version of this episode, plus citations and footnotes, go to freeross.org/railroaded.
Thank you for listening. If you're interested in the case and you want to help support the family, there's a few things you can do. You can share this episode out with your friends and family on social media. Visit my website page for the episode, which is linked from the homepage. You'll be able to watch the YouTube version, which includes supporting imagery. You can visit the Free Ross website to find out more information on the case, which is at freeross.org. You can follow the Free Ross campaign on Twitter, @free_Ross. You can follow Ross on Twitter, @RealRossU, you just being the letter U. You can sign the petition for clemency. There's a link on the homepage of the website which takes you through where you can do this. You can also make a donation and buy something from the Free Ross website. And if you have any questions, feel free to get in touch.